Access number 28675, Mr. Eric Smith, Reel 3. Now, we're talking about when you first joined the fifth Tank Regiment at Beni Youssef. How did you settle in with the lads then? Did you make friends quickly?
Very quickly, yeah. There were 8 of us to a tent, bell tents.
Well, tell me about them first then. If you're going to, what were the bell tents like?
The round tent they call a bell tent, like a bell. 8 of us with your beds all feet together. And a sergeant or a corporal in charge. He'd be in charge of it. And he was a Sergeant Black.
Now, how crowded was that?
Not really, no. No,
was
quite
it
big.
Stuffy in there, or...?
No, because the flaps were open. And nights get cold, of course, in the desert, as you know. No. They were very, very pleasant people.
Let's go on to... who were they? What sort of lad were they? Were they older than you, or what? The other... drivers.
One or two were older, regulars, but majority by that time were conscripts owing to casualties. And the sergeant in charge, Sergeant Black, was a bus conductor from Glasgow.
What was he like?
A wonderful man. Got killed at Ellamain.
What about the lads? Tell me a bit more about the lads.
Well, they all mucked in. We were all, they accepted you and learnt you about the desert. The life, what to do and what not to do. And your lorry had we made a cupboard in the back of the lorry out of ammunition cases. And they said, well, stock up with tea, sugar, tin milk, get plenty of provisions on board because you'll need them up the blue, as they called it. So they were very helpful and very good. We had a lance corporal in charge of us, Lofty Farringdon, but the Sergeant Black was excellent.
So what was Farringdon like?
Nice bloke, yeah, nice, Lofty.
But what about the other officers? I mean, you've got your major, but what about the other officers?
Majority were good, yes.
Did you see much of them?
The officer in charge of transport was a chap called Stoward, Oscar.
Stoward?
S-T-O-W-A-R-D, Oscar Stoward.
What was he like?
Well, I got on well with him, but he was 6'2", so impossible to put in a tank, because he'd have been about half out the turret. He went in a tank and got injured eventually, but he was in charge, and he was so tall with very prominent teeth, and he knew it, and everybody called him Teeth and Trousers. That was his nickname. Poor old Oscar, he got... But he was in charge of transport. When we went up the blue and moved up to the front line, he led the column.
Now, when you first, what happens when you first get there? Anything happening while you're at Beni Youssef?
Well, I get issued with a lorry. And go down to Cairo Railway Station, load up with ammo each day, bringing it back.
Now, tell me, what would a typical trip to fetch it? What did it entail?
Well, drive to Cairo, and then you back up to the train, and the Egyptians mostly would load the load, all kinds of ammunition. And once you got your load aboard, you'd return to camp, and then debus it to different tanks, fit them up with shells and whatever they wanted. We did that for several weeks.
Any other duties?
Guards.
What were guard duties like then?
Well, what they call patrol guards. 2 of you would walk around with a gun.
Round the camp?
Round the camp at night, yes. Because you weren't careful. The old, as wogs as we called them, used to come thieving and so forth. But otherwise, yes. And I say they were regular NCOs, but... fair and good. The only mistake I made, I'd been with them about 2 days on guard, and the following morning they said, right, put up the flag. And it was, their flag was red and blue. Each regiment had a tag on their shoulder. What did I do? Put the flag upside down. Sergeant Major, not Sergeant, RSM. Who put the flag up? He let me off because I was a new recruit. But if it happens again, he said, your feet won't touch, But he was another good bloke. He led the column, what we called a Y packet, that followed the tanks. About 8 lorries followed the tanks.
We'll come to that. Now, what happens next then? You're still outside, you're still at Beni Youssef. How long were you there?
We were there till beginning of March.
And anything happened while you were there? Any other things?
No, just... going to town each night and enjoy yourselves if you wanted to. And
so what would you do in Cairo?
Well, me, not being a drinker or anything, 2 or 3 of us, say birds of a feather flock together, we would go and have a soft drink in the Stanley Club, as it was called. That was mainly manned by regular officer's wife who was stationed in Cairo. And I say, we did the museum, a cinema, went and saw Gone with the Wind twice. Generally speaking, just enjoyed ourselves.
Is this when you went to the pyramids as well?
We were, say, inside of the pyramids. They're only
what
about
did
a
you think of them?
Well, I thought it was marvellous, really. We did go up to them, of course, had a camel ride.
Did you climb the side of one, or...?
It lowered them down on the ground and put your steps in.
No,
walk round them, but didn't go inside, no.
And so what happens next then?
I say then, being about the first week in March, we move up to the blue, up the desert, in stages.
Now, what do you remember of your first experience of going to the desert then?
Well, because they said strict discipline with convoys, with distance, you weren't allowed to close up because of air bombing. So you had strict discipline of keeping apart. They'd be checking on you all the time. And in the forward lorry, the officer or NCO would have a turret in the cab with his head and shoulders out. And first sight of aircraft or noise, he'd wave his hand, you got the signal, and you'd jump out of the lorry and run away far away from it as you could. But that took, I think, about 2 days, 3 days, and we got to Mirza Matruh.
Now, was this on road or was this desert?
On a metal road, so yes.
No different from normal driving?
No. The only thing you had to be careful of with the heat, your tyres used to expand. They'd go from normal pressure to 10 or 15 pounds more than they should be. If you took air out by the morning, they'd be flat, you know, it's cold night. No, it's quite a...
Now, what happened when you got to Mirza Matruh?
Well, that was a staging, that's all, for about a night. Then we went on to Sidi Barani. And then our next stop was into the desert itself, to Knightsbridge, where the battle started in May 42. Sidi Rezaig we crossed, where they'd fought the previous November. Visited several graves of people they knew.
And what were conditions like in desert driving? What was it like driving in the desert when you were off the metal road?
Not too bad, really, because fortunately the Canadian lorries had sand tyres.
And what do you mean by that?
Proper tyres for the desert.
But in what way proper?
Their tread. Whereas British had the old clump tyres, which churned up the ground. But these were what they call sand tyres. And they're marvellous trucks. I thought it was wonderful.
And what was it like driving? Was there anything else you've got there? Any skills you needed?
Yes, you had to be careful of soft sand.
And how could you tell where it was soft?
Well, you just ran into it, really, but it was very difficult, you know. Four-wheel drive we had. And also we had what we call desert sand shields. Take them off the side of the lorry, lay them down like you do when you're in snow, and drive onto those and get out of it. It was avoided generally by those who'd got desert craft, those who'd been before and knew where to go. So I was lucky to join a regular, experienced regiment. Owe my life to them.
Now, what happened next? So you're moving up further and further up into the desert.
By that time, March
and April.
Yeah, and by that time we're moving into the desert, and it becomes very, very, very hot.
Now, tell me about the desert climate then.
The desert
climate.
Yeah, very, very hot. About 120, and could drop to about 50 at night.
Now, how did you cope with those extremes of temperature?
Well, everybody seemed to cope fairly well. There was no trouble, no odd case of dysentery. Sanitary conditions. You dug a hole and covered it up with sand. That's all you had.
So you didn't have a proper latrine?
No. Only when you were static, and then they'd have a sanitary waller, and he'd dig holes and put a bar across it, what you sat on. Then fill it, throw petrol in, burn it up, and then cover it in with sand. No proper latrines, no. Just a shovel. Get as far away from the lorry as you could. And
was there much trouble with dysentery or diarrhoea early on?
Not a lot, no. The odd case got bad and he went into a hospital in Tobruk.
But you didn't get it?
No, I didn't.
So, yeah, what happened? You're moving in. What about the food you got in the desert?
Well, it's mostly corned beef and biscuits, hardtack. Never saw fresh meat, of course, or fresh vegetables.
And how appropriate was corned beef and biscuits for the conditions?
Well, the corned beef, you'd pour out the tin, of course. But the cooks would put it in batter, they would roast it, you'd have it cold, corned beef stew. They did all sorts. They were marvellous in this. They got the art of cooking corned beef. And the one lorry in our column was a cookhouse lorry, and the fellow driving it was Taff Rodder, wonderful man. He only died a couple of years ago at 90. He was a regular soldier, but he drove the cook. He was an elderly man. He was 37 when they recalled him up, so he was put out on a cookhouse lorry driver. But he was a great friend of mine. I liked Taff very much.
So the food was
basic, but enough. Yes.
What about the biscuits? I mean, how?
They were those hard, like dog biscuits. We used to make porridge with them, and we put them on the front of the tank and in a bag, hit them with a hammer, make them crumbs, and then make them what we call burgoo, Indian porridge. Put a tin of carnation milk in it, and a bit of, if we've got any sugar, could spare a bit, and make good porridge.
Now, what about water? Water supply?
Very, very scarce. Water was very scarce. At times, we were on 2 pints a day.
Now, how did you use your 2 pints? I mean,
well, we all mucked in together, put all your water together, so then you had a... at that time, the petrol cans, you may have heard this before, the petrol cans, what they call flimsies, terrible cans that we were using. Half the petrol used to disappear before it got you. We all took on the jerry can, of course, which was so superior.
The German one?
Yes, but these 4 gallon cans were like that. We used to get a jackknife and cut it in two, and then we'd stand in one half and wash each other down, and then keep the water, put it through a bit of muslin or something, and put it back in a can. And often I have done this only about twice, for a shave, if it was possible. I'd drain hot water out the rad, and then when I'd shave, put it back in again
in the radiator.
Yes.
And what about drinking? Was there enough drinking water?
Not really, no, but tea was the main, always brewing, impossible. And you drink it with a spoon to make it last. Just wet your lips. But only at times it was so tight, when you were in battle and when you were well in the desert. But otherwise, when you got back nearer the coast, supplies were quite good.
So how did you make your tea? Because
loose tea, of course.
But a lot of desert things had a quick way of brewing up using petrol and things like that.
Petrol fire you use.
Tell us about how you brew up tea quickly then.
Well, we had these petrol cans again. Cut the lid out the top and punch holes in the side. Fill them with sand. Pour on a gallon of petrol. Stand well back and throw a match. And the tea would brew in a couple of minutes. Or the water. And you get an old glove or something. Lift off the Dixie. Pour it on the tea leaves. Of course, bags weren't invented by then. And make a decent cup of char. Tin milk. And we got sugar. Ample. If you hadn't got enough sugar, a naffy wagon would come round. One of our own lorries would go to Tobruk, fill up with toothpaste, all necessities of life. And then they'd come back and you could buy it. So we'd always got sort of adequate tea and sugar. Yeah. Oh, yeah, we did well. You improvised. It's surprising. Well, they say poverty is the mother of invention. We got by marvellously. And I've heard it said, perhaps it's not true, that the British adapted to desert conditions even better than the Germans ever did. Germans couldn't get on top of it. But
now, how were you? So you were settling in well.
Oh, yes.
Moving into April, I think.
I was quite happy, I can say, you know, yeah.
And where are you, what are your duties as ammunition thing there?
Guards, of course. And in my truck, I carried for defence of the column, I had an American 505, I think it was, on a tripod.
A Browning.
On a tripod. And whenever we were static and going to stay there a little while, this was got out of the lorry, put in a proper place, and we kept it clean, because oil and sand don't mix, but you had to clean it with petrol. Get it all ready in case the Jerrys came over. Only once did I use it against German attacking planes.
Now, in the early days, were there any German attacks on the column?
No, nothing at all.
No air attacks? No.
The odd, but not much, no. We never got attacked in that area of Knightsbridge at all.
So what happened next then?
Well, that was up until the 26th, 27th of May. We'd been warned that we would be going into action any time. The colonel had briefed us all. A Colonel Uniacke, he was another nice fellow. And he warned us that before long we'd be into battle. And
Colonel Uniac, he's the regiment commander.
Commander in the regiment, so yeah. Uniac.
What was he like? Cause
a nice man, a regular soldier.
Did you see him, or did you know him?
No, I only met him once. And that was when we first joined, and he'd only just taken the regiment over. The colonel before him was a Colonel Drew. But Uniac was quite a nice man.
How do you know, then, if you only met him once? You see what I mean? How did he...
Well, as he commanded the regiment and his way he conducted it, you know, I think he was a fair man.
So his reputation was good?
Oh, very good, yes.
So although you didn't see him much, you heard of him?
No, we got introduced to him, but of course that was all we ever saw. But,
Now, what happened when he got to Knightsbridge?
As I say,
end of May.
Bir Hakeim and Knightsbridge. That was 27th of May, and they'd warned us that we would be attacking soon, but Jerry forestalled us. He attacked before we did. And reconnaissance didn't pick him up soon enough, and he did what they called a left hook. He came up and caught two of the regiments still in bed. 3rd Tanks and 8th Hussars were still sleeping when he hit. So we were lucky just to sort of scrabble our trousers on and get ready for him. So the divisional commander was captured the first day, quite a few people, and he knocked hell out of them. But the Grants gave him a shock. They were able to knock him out, which he'd never experienced before.
Now, this is the attack. So this is 27th
of May.
This attack on you. We haven't mentioned it. So you were in 7th Armoured, Dave.
That's
you?
Right, yes.
And where were you? Were you in part of the... Where did you see any of the attack, or where were you?
Oh, yes, because I was on a transport, and there were... 8 lorries followed the tanks into action always. 2 ammo, 2 petrol, ambulance, spare kit, Pradri, about 8 vehicles following. And we were called Y Packet. We were on the heels of the tanks. When they came out of action, they'd radio up, and then you'd pull forward and restock them with ammo.
And you were doing that?
We were doing that,
so what
yes.
did you see that day?
Well, we were chased. We knew Jerry had broken through, and we, my first experience, we just went, said, right, go hell for leather towards the sun, which is the west. And we went hell for leather, and we finished up at a little aerodrome called Gambut. G-A-M-B-U-T,
so
Gambut.
You were actually ordered to retreat before you actually saw any fighting.
He was coming up with a half track. We could see the Jerrys, and he was taking transport. And we didn't know afterwards, which of course makes sense, the order of the day was to capture as much enemy transport as possible, because you need transport and supplies to sustain in advance, and he was short of transport. So much was getting sunk from Italy to Tripoli. So he wanted transport, and he captured Lofty Farringdon. Oh, quite a few of them were put in the bag, and I did manage to get away. I had a few machine gun bullets through the tailboard.
Don't you remember of that? I mean, what happened?
I just remember Jerry coming up and the confusion going on, and we just went for hell for leather and finished up at Gambut, as I say. And there, of course, there was lorries from every regiment had all panicked and gone back to there. Next day somebody came and formed us up into some sort of into some sort of order, and we rejoined the regiment, but they were decimated, the 3rd and 5th. After a while, they were so knocked about that we became the 3rd, 5th for a while. Colonel was killed about the first week in June. In a sandstorm, they ran onto German anti-tank guns. He was killed, the adjutant was killed. Lost quite a few men. But I do remember that, being in a truck, and Dickie Ward, as I said, the major of our squadron, I can remember him now. He got a honey tank, a little light tank, Stuart. And he was going forward and picking up chaps lying on the ground who otherwise would be taken prisoner. So he was bold and direct. But that was chaos, of course. You know, you didn't know what was going on. But from then on, we sort of assembled again together, 2 regiments into one. And
That's at Gambut, was it?
Gambut, yeah.
Gambot.
G-A-M-B-U-T, Gambut, yeah. I think that's right.
And you joined with the 1st tank regiment?
3rd. 3rd, 5th, we were called. I've got a book on it, actually, called the 3rd, 5th.
Now, what happened then? You know, you've formed this amalgamation unit.
Uh-huh. Well, then it was sort of... action and retreat, gradually, you see, until that was May, till the middle of June, when we went right back towards Tobruk.
Now, what was the fighting like during that? I mean, you were again still on transport.
Yes, you could observe tanks going up in flames. It was pretty horrendous, really. At night, when you got into Liga, as they called it, Liga, you all get together, or a harbour, and the soft skin vehicles are inside, and the tanks are poised around the outside. Everybody does a guard on their own vehicle, take it in turns.
And what would happen in the Lager? I mean, or was it just, they'd just stay there?
We stay there for the night, that's all, and move into position next morning. What Jerry would have a habit of doing, he would shell about every half hour to keep you on your toes. Every now and again you get whee, whomp, and that was to keep stop people sleeping and wouldn't be so alert the next day for action. They called it a nuisance gun.
And what happened next?
Well, I'll say, we odd battles the tanks fought, and they were getting decimated. We were hardly any tanks left at all.
But you didn't see any of that?
Only observed it from a distance, the fighting, and, yeah. He was bombing quite a bit, of course. He got the superiority by then. And his objective, of course, which
now, what was it like being under a bombing attack? Or were you
pretty horrible, really.
Can you describe it? Was it Stukas or what was it?
Stukas, mostly, yes. Oh. With that scream and the bombs whistling down. I say you ran, if it was possible, you ran as far as you could from the lorry. When the thumps, you know, you shake on the ground. And frightening, really. Yeah. We had a few injured with shrapnel, but I was lucky. All I ever got was a small piece in my knee.
When was that?
That was summer of 42, yeah, when he bombed. Only a splinter. I still got the mark, but otherwise I was very lucky. Must have had a guardian angel, I think.
So you're pulling back, you're under attack.
We're falling back day by day. And then they at night they'd say, right, we're falling back to Chafersin, which was on the Egyptian border. Now we're falling back to Mirza Matru. Now we're falling back to El Daba. Now we're falling back to Fuka. Now, and of course, the last stop was Al Ain. That was what? End of June. He took up to Tobruk in June, didn't he? Very sad. And two of their regiments intact he took into Tobruk. 4th Battalion and the 7th.
Now what happened when he got to Al Alamein?
Well, they'd already preparing positions. We pulled back and the tanks took up position, and slit trenches were the order of the day, of course.
Now, would you help dig them, or?
We did it, yeah, it all helped, yeah. Some were being done by the Rocky with the Royal Engineers with drills making holes for gun pits and things like that. But he bombed us quite a bit there. It was pretty frightening. We used to call it Stuka Valley. He'd come over with the sun in the morning and the sun at night.
Now, these defensive positions, would you dig in your vehicle, your truck? Cause you can
what
dig you,
yeah, what we had to do was, all we ever do, or as much as you could do, even when we were up in the desert waiting for the attack, you'd dig and just put the bonnet, so the bonnet was level with the ground. The rear of the truck, you couldn't cover the whole truck, it's true, but the bonnet would go down into the ground.
So the engine was...
Engine, that's right, protected.
And what about these Stuka trucks? Any different, or are they more intensive? What were they like? Anything else to say about them, or?
Raids got more frequent, of course. And of course, he captured aerodromes nearer the front line, and he kept up regular attacks all day, and, you know, terrible, really. I think the bombing was some of the... As a driver on a truck, bombing was some of the worst we experienced. Long-range shelling we got. He had a big gun called a 210mm, and that he would... He knew the form. When the tanks are forward, he knows the supplies are sitting behind, so he would shell us regularly.
And how effective was the shelling, the 210mm shelling?
Pretty accurate, but again, I only saw once or twice a truck destroyed. And then if it got too intense, often it was the RSM in a little truck, he would put his hand out and go...
Circle round.
And then he'd come round and go back, and then we'd all turn and go back and fall back a little bit out of range.
Now, what's the next thing you remember then? You're taking up these positions, you're under more and more Stuka and 210mm.
That's right, and of course the ground activity was very fierce. Jerry was throwing all he could, and he'd come to Al Alamein with what he captured in Tobruk. food, the storage and what he captured in petrol and food was colossal. He said afterwards he never got to Brook, never got to Alamein without Tobruk.
What happens next? What's the next thing you remember?
Well, a big attack went in, the first Alamein, as we called it. A big attack went in about the 15th of June.
This is a German attack?
British.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay, British. The first part of Alamein.
Yes. He would send out patrols and very active during the day with shelling, but it was more or less observing each other. And, of course, in those days, it was so hot and a mirage. You know, it's very, very confusing, especially when you're on your feet and you're tired out. But he attacked from time to time, but fortunately our artillery was very good. We managed to hold him. And then about the middle of June, Auchinleck decided to attack. And unfortunately, you may have read it or heard about it, a new brigade had just come out from England, the 8th Armoured Brigade. And their arm was go, go boys. And they were, poor devils, weren't climatised. They rushed out in August 42. They weren't climatised to desert conditions. Their vehicles weren't, prepared for desert conditions. In the urgency of the time, they were thrown straight into battle. And by somebody's bad management, they went straight onto a minefield. Most of them were lost, three regiments that day, for nothing.
And that's...
They had Valentine's. Terrible.
That's 15th of June.
About the middle of June, yeah. By then, after that, there wasn't much activity, only shelling and bombing. I think Jerry was at the end of his tether, and so were we. So both sides sort of pulled back and licked their wounds. And then, when was it? Then we were relieved by the Royal Scots Greys, went back to a staging area called Amaria Salt Flats.
Where's that?
Just outside Alexandria.
Can you spell Amaria?
Amaria. A-M-E-R-I-A, I think. Amaria. As it's Amaria. Salt Flats. It was a staging area for the army to sort of refit and regroup. We came back there and were given 6 days leave.
What did you do with that?
I opted for Cairo. I went with a friend, another smith, and we went into a hostel, sheets on the beds, lived like human beings once more for 6 days. And we had a good 6 days in Cairo, visited many places of interest, Sphinx, the pyramids, museum, general, cinema twice. We enjoyed the 6 days. And he didn't drink, so we were in good company with each other. They always say birds of a feather flock together, don't they?
Now, how did you get on with the Egyptians?
Generally speaking, yeah, they were a bit tiresome, the youngsters, with their black boot black. They'd throw it on you if you didn't have your boots clean. They'd pester you so much. But you had to be watching them. They were clifty wallers, you know.
In what way?
Well, they'd pinch it, turn your back, and, you know, you'd lost something. But I always say now, I didn't know the full facts. We sort of thought, blooming wogs, we resented them. But it was their country, and we shouldn't have been there. Not at the time, as a young squaddy, I didn't realise that.